thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Like,
here's John Williams.
What happened to the traffic reporter? Here we go. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are downtown Chicago. 18 stories above the Chicago River, looking out onto the city and beautiful Lake Michigan. On social media, I am WGN King John. I want to be king someday. Remember, we're here until 3 o'clock weekdays, and then on Saturdays from 10 a.m. till 12 noon, do enjoy the Mincing Rascals podcast. It's a weekly podcast we record here at WGN Radio. It covers all kinds of current events recently determined by the Lissagor Award Committee to be the best podcast in Chicago. Violetta's saddled up to the microphone over there. Hey, V, you got any traffic headlines for us? Is there anything really super important that we should know about?
Travel times are pretty light. Inbound Eisenhower is a little heavy. It's 45 minutes, 390 to the old post office, just 30 minutes back out.
Going to feature some music in this half hour. Can we start with Benny and the Jets? I know that's not what we decided to do in the pre-show meeting, Producer Olaf, but go ahead and hit a little Benny and the Jets.
Do you want me to sing it?
No, I want you to play Elton John doing it.
Okay, sure.
Wasn't that what we had? Did we have that in the queue?
No.
Is Ben Zobrist going to walk out, too?
No. Not Benny and the Jets. Rocket Man. Play Rocket Man.
Okay, just give me 2 seconds.
3, 2, 1.
More than 2 seconds.
So I've got some music on my mind today for two reasons. One was yesterday we had a conversation about music, and I thought it would help if we actually listened a little more to the music before we made up our mind about the burning question that we addressed yesterday at the end of the show. Also, Rocket Man is in the news. Rocket Man, burning out his shoes on the telephone. Since we're going down a musical lane in this hour, I thought we'd start with this. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. Mike Pompeo went over to North Korea. He's your Secretary of State, you know. And he wants to further the North Korean talks that began, and evidently they didn't go as well as we had hoped. Afterwards, everybody tries to put a bow on it, but according to CNN, one source knowledgeable with the discussion said, quote, they went as badly as they could have gone. It was hoped that Mike Pompeo would get a chance to see Kim Jong-un. Un wouldn't have him. You fly all the way to North Korea, which I don't think is easy. Even when you're flying for the president, it's still a long way. And you're fussy and you've got jet lag. You know, the nicest planes in the world still have jet lag in them. And then you get there and you walk around and you're eating that food and talking to these people. And it's just, does that sound like fun? But you want to meet Kim Jong-un and then Un won't see you. And he had a gift from the President of the United States that he wanted to give him, an autographed copy of Rocket Man by Elton John, autographed by the President, but still autographed, CD or album, or maybe a 45, I don't know, it was probably a CD of that song. Why? Because the President used to mock Kim Jong-un and he called him Rocket Man. Now, I'm not exactly sure how that works. Like, what's the thinking behind that? Like, hey, we all knew it was a joke, no big deal, Mr. Chairman, here's a copy of Rocket Man. Evidently, when they did meet in person, the president asked him. He said, hey, have you ever heard of Elton John's Rocket Man? And Kim Jong-un said, no, I haven't, you dotard. So he said, well, I'll get you a copy of it. So then here comes Mike Pompeo. God, this is so bizarre. Here comes Mike Pompeo with a copy of the song that sort of sings about the mockery that the president made of the leader of North Korea, the very temperamental president or leader of North Korea. So I'm just not sure if from like a psychology standpoint, I don't know, how do you deal with these people? I'm not sure if that was a good move. I'm not certain that's why Kim Jong-un didn't want to see him. Probably not. But how would that have helped? Hey, remember when the president was making fun of you? Remember when he said you were a little rocket man? Here's the song. I mean, would that have worked? Would that have been a good idea? Is that a good play, right? That's my question. And I'm going to guess maybe not. I mean, if you just said to me, hey, John, Violetta or Elif were making fun of you the other day, and you know, that lyric in the song that was always making fun of you, well, here's the CD. Isn't this awesome? They signed it for you. I don't know that I would be receptive to that. To me, that's not a peace offering.
It's more of an insult.
Yeah, it's just rubbing salt in the wound is what it is.
So I don't exactly understand the logic behind that.
I think that's the problem. You're trying to find the logic here.
Shame on me. I talked today to a psychologist from Yellow Brick. You know the people we do those commercials for? Yellow Brick. It's a facility in Evanston where they work with young people who have failed to launch. This is not a commercial for them, but I thought about them when I was thinking about those kids that were in the cave. I was thinking about the kids in the cave in Thailand who for 10 days were sitting there in the dark with their coach. Finally, a diver shows up, but it was a week before they were all able to get out of there. And I wondered how traumatic that would be for them. So I said, what happens to people when they go through a kind of trauma like that? Her name was Dr. Zhongmi Yi, who talked to me about it, and it was just fascinating. She said that the 11-year-olds probably have a different mindset than maybe the 16-year-olds. She said that it would not be surprised if the kids suffered from flashbacks, if they developed a fear of water or dark places, if they didn't demonstrate some sort of symptoms of an acute stress disorder, stomach aches, headaches. If you've ever gone through something terribly traumatic, or if your kids have, you would recognize some of the same symptoms. This was helpful, though, that they were all in it together. She said that was very helpful that they weren't isolated, and that when somebody emerges from a traumatic situation like that, what's helpful is that you help those people reestablish a sense of safety. Safety.
But also, I have to think that they would feel a little bit accomplished. You know, there were some seemingly dead ends there that they got through and they pulled themselves out. You know, obviously they had a lot of help, but they had to put in a lot of work and effort, and then it paid off in the end.
I didn't ask her about that. That's an interesting point. Like if that might buffer
a sense of resilience,
right?
And being able to survive. And,
yeah, we did it. By God, it didn't get us. We got it.
Right.
Maybe so. She did say that after people endure some sort of natural calamity, a hurricane, a tornado, a 9/11, whatever, it's not unusual for them to go through a debriefing, a kind of group therapy where people sit there and talk about what they went through. And when they discover that they have a shared experience, it's helpful to them. Oh, man, you're thinking the same things I'm thinking. You're feeling the same things I'm thinking. Oh, good. I'm glad I'm not alone in this. But she probably said the phrase sense of safety to me a half a dozen times. And we were talking about, and I said, is this true not just for these kids in the cave, but for my kids and your kids here in the Chicago area? If we went through some sort of trauma, is establishing a sense of safety, family, community. You can't fix what happened. You don't know what's going on in their brain, but here's what you can do. Make them feel home and make them feel safe. If you've had a kid who's gone through some sort of trauma, you probably are nodding your head right now if you got good advice. She said that, and this is interesting, in Asia, and this is a broad brush, but there are cultural mores and attitudes. And she said it's not uncommon in Asian countries for the people to be less empathetic towards psychological trauma. Mental health is not as advanced, say, there as it is here. Here it's okay to say I've suffered and I'm suffering and my brain isn't right about this. There, not so much. And so, while those kids might carry the psychological trauma, maybe the community isn't as embracing of what's going on internally. And then the illness tends to manifest itself physically. So then you see more headaches and stomach aches because they can't process it verbally, and people don't really embrace the mental anguish you go through. So now it's just going to internalize and become a physical conundrum for you, as well as a psychological one. But she said that there is also the sense that these kids are from, I think, a small community, and if the community embraces them, if they're with their moms and dads, if they're hugging them, if they have a sense of safety, she says you never grow out of it. I use that phrase. Do you eventually grow out of it? She says you don't grow out of it, but you work through it. Again, if you had a kid who's gone through some sort of trauma, are you nodding your head? They can work through it. Dr. Zhongmi Yi talked to me about this earlier today, and I was glad that she was able to give me some insight. By the way, that place at Yellow Brick, when a person goes there, the assessment for what they're going through will take 3 to 7 days. I said, I understand that you guys are pretty good about the intake, that you really get to know the kids before you help them. She said 3 days, sometimes 7 days. We make sure we know where they are before we try and prescribe something for them. The next time I speak on this radio show about the woman who is wearing the Puerto Rico flag on her shirt at the Forest Preserve in Cook County, remind me to first say that what that guy did was wrong. I don't think I got in front of that enough yesterday. The point I was trying to make yesterday, if you were listening at this time, you may have heard, was along the lines of the guy who tore the Make America Great Again hat off the kid and threw a soda in his face and stormed out. That guy's in a world of legal trouble. And all I was saying was that when these things go viral and everybody talks about them and the whole world watches them, I think their importance, significance, or crime get exaggerated. And there was Steve Bertrand saying, well, these things should never happen. They should never happen.
On his high horse.
Well, Steve was right. I probably needed to establish that first.
So, right. So your point is that my point is that they should definitely be punished. And if they're only punished because it's seen online, well, then that's part of it. Your point is that it's then goes beyond what should be done.
I agree.
Okay. Right.
I think we're in the same place on that. And now there's two people that we're talking about in the punishment phase of the woman at the Forest Preserve with the Puerto Rico t-shirt. One is that knucklehead drunk doof who was harassing her. I'm not sure what's going to happen to him. He was arrested and charged. But more of greater concern to a lot of people is the Forest Preserve police officer who didn't seem to be very involved in her safety. What happens to that guy? He's got desk duty now. And the question we asked yesterday was, is that a fireable offense? Roe brought it up during crosstalk at 3. Roe said he doesn't think that's a fireable offense. I said, I don't think it is either. Maybe that cop is lucky that nothing happened, right? Like if that guy punches that lady in the nose, if he really harms her and the cop is standing there, he's out of a job. But the guy was just a belligerent drunk and nothing happened and the cop was just hovering around the scene. I don't know why he didn't intervene. I wish he had. All different subjects and thoughts about the same scene. Remind me to be on the right side first when I talk about that. Towards the end of yesterday's show, incidentally, our news click is asking you about that. Did the news click? Yeah, here's the news click for today. Cook County Forest Preserve, belligerent man confronts a woman wearing a shirt that features the flag of Puerto Rico. The officer did little to help the woman. You get three options, campers. What should you do? A, he should be fired. B, he should be punished, but he gets to keep his job. Or C, he didn't do anything wrong. He keeps his job. Where are you? A, B, or C? That's our news click. It's a daily web poll question at WGNradio.com. And it's on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. It was reported yesterday that Drake has broken the Beatles record.
Love that guy.
He now has 7 songs in the top 10 simultaneously. 7 of the top 10 songs are Drake songs. The Beatles had the old record set over 50 years ago when they dropped 5 songs in the top 10 at the same time. While we were all talking about Drake versus the Beatles, we weren't listening to much Drake versus the Beatles. Let's do a little of that. After this on WGN. Everybody get your... Number one song in America. Your hip quotient's going to go up this afternoon. You'll be able to say, yeah, I've heard Drake. Working hard, girl, everything paid for. First, last phone, bill, car, no cable. With your phone out, gotta hit them angles. With your phone out, snapping like you Fable. And you're showing off, but it's all right. And you're showing off. But it's all right. You can't understand all the words to that. That's okay. I went to see Phantom. I didn't understand a word they were saying or singing, so it's not a problem.
So similar.
No, but really, I mean...
It is similar, yeah.
I go, oh, that was great music. What were the words? I couldn't tell you a one of them. So I think you just listen to the music. Do you like the music? That was and is the number one song in America. Okay, 1964, this was the number one song in America. This is the Beatles. If you're watching us on the stream, I don't care too much
money, but money can buy me love.
That's number one.
I'll give you all I've got.
Okay, so that's number one versus number one. I think it's a fair battle. The Drake song was awesome, and, you know, that's the Beatles, for crying out loud. Okay, so here is Drake's song, Nonstop. It is currently number two on the charts.
Future took the business and ran it for me. I let Ali take the aisle, told him.
This is what you were afraid of. This is what you thought of, that hip-hop rap crap. What is that?
Gotta hand it to me. Gotta give me this shit, dog. Prayed, then I prayed again, baby. Had a moment, but it came and went.
All right, that's Drake, and that is Nonstop. All right, Elif, let's listen to the Beatles. This is the Beatles. That's Drake, number two on the charts. Here's the Beatles, number two on the charts.
Yeah.
How can you not? It's physically impossible not to start doing the blender.
Come on, Steve. I mean, Justice.
Do the blender. Right. I told my hips stop, and they said no. Okay, so that's Drake's number two.
Two to two.
Song, and two to two.
I would say we're starting to get a little bit different here.
I say the Beatles won the second round, but I'd say it's a push in the first round. Okay, so here's Drake. This is his song. It's number four on the charts.
I don't want to die for them to miss me. Yes, I see the things that they wishing on me. Hope I got some brothers that outlive me. They gon' tell the story, shit was different with me. God's plan, God's plan. I hold back, sometimes I won't. I feel good sometimes.
I don't know how to dance to this one.
This is a head nod.
Go down to G-O-D, yeah, wait. I go hard on Southside G, yeah, wait. I make sure that Northside E. And still, bad things. It's a lot of bad things that they wish and they wish and they wish and they wish and they wish.
What a great song. What a great song.
He's
okay.
Starting to sound a little bit like Chance.
I was thinking that myself. All right, so that'll be enough of that there, Producer Elif. Let's go from, that's Drake, number four on the charts with God's Plan. Here's the Beatles, number three on the charts.
She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, 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 yeah.
Drake wins this round, am I right?
You think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday, yeah. It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say, yeah. She said she loves you, and you know that can't be bad.
All right, so
I had to listen a little, because that's the first time I heard that song.
You know your microphone's on, right?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
It's kind of background music, though. That's one of those ones where you could be going into an ice cream parlor and the 60s.
Right, is on.
And you
go, that's one of those songs, but you didn't track. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Well, somebody asked yesterday, hey, 50 years from now, are they going to be playing Drake? 50 years from now, they play the Beatles, and you don't recognize them. So that's fair. Okay, so here's Drake. This is his song at number six on the charts, In My Feelings.
Kiki, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never.
Producer Jasmine says there's a dance for this.
Jasmine's
doing
killing
it right now.
She is killing it. Let's see it. You want to show it to us?
Yeah, show it to John, and then John put
She's
it on
running
the camera.
Because I'm still doing the blender.
They run it out of options because I've been going off, and they don't know when to stop it. I thought you would have won from the
I want to know the move.
Track money, Benny.
Maybe she'll cut a video for us later on. Isn't this awesome?
Say you never ever leave from beside me because I want you and I need you.
This reminds me of ABBA.
Cause I want you and I need you.
Well, honestly, the purpose of this segment is that you know something culturally seismic has happened, right? The Beatles no longer own the record for the most simultaneous songs on the charts. It was eclipsed by somebody called Drake by two songs, 7 of 10 on the charts. So you ought to know what that is or what that sounds like, and that's Drake, In My Feelings.
Honestly, those songs were good, but they're kind of boring.
The Drake songs?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a...
You know, they're not catchy. Like, you're not going to sing along to them. That's, I think, the difference. Like, you can listen and appreciate it, but there's only certain parts you really are going to sing.
So you're not loving Drake, huh?
Well, look, Violetta, I've never judged a song I like by whether I would sing with it, because I would never do that.
Oh, well, I sing along with every song I listen to.
I know, it's just, sure, just what I'm saying. It's just different.
That's a thing. Right, but not for you, Steve, right? I think that's not an uncommon way to judge a song. If you sing along with it, you tend to like it, right? Well, I like
if I sing along with it, I'm insulting it.
or you're insulting the people around you, that's for sure. It's 1:30, and we'll listen to a little more of them as the show moves along, but that's the 1964 and 2018 chart toppers, the Beatles and Drake. So here's the story from InsideEdition.com about George Clooney, released from the hospital after being thrown from his motor scooter and onto the windshield of a Mercedes on the Italian island of Sardinia. The Ocean's 11 actor is currently filming Catch 22 on the island. He was on his way to the set at 8:15 in the morning, reportedly driving 60 miles an hour on State Road 125, when a driver did not respect the right-of-way and cut off Clooney's scooter. The Italian, somebody said.
Yeah, it looks like the car kind of got into the wrong spot and then realized it and stopped. And then the first scooter that Clooney was with got around him, but Clooney's scooter didn't.
Clooney was wearing a helmet. Which was broken by the force of the impact on the Mercedes. He's said to have been hurled 20 feet in the air. Do you remember the one where Evel Knievel tries the thing and he does a somersault over his motorcycle on impact? Anyway, that's kind of what it looked like. He was taken to a nearby hospital in the city of Olbia after complaining of a slight trauma to the pelvis and bruises to one arm and leg. They say he was treated and released and is at home. He's recovering. They say he'll be back on the scene after recovering from a bruised knee in 20 days. That guy is lucky to be alive. It was not his time. You drive your thing 60 miles an hour into a Mercedes, and you do that?
It's going to take more than that to get George Clooney. We'd be dead.
I think a lot of women were like, oh, not George. A lot of men were, too. A lot of us have a man crush on George Clooney.
He's so cool.
He is so cool, and he's so good-looking, and he's...
The twins bring him down a little bit, but whatever.
What do you mean by that?
I think he's, like, faking this whole, like, wanting to be a dad thing.
Well, he is a father. The kids are not fake. You understand that?
The kids are not fake. Yeah.
You don't know. Maybe he's a great hands-on dad. Maybe he's totally embracing at his
age.
Yeah,
but it takes away a little bit from the...
Right, I know.
Cool.
It's a different kind of George Clooney.
Wait a minute.
You gotta get your head around that.
Dads can't be cool?
No, they can be very cool, but guys...
Look at John. John's incredibly cool.
Been dads longer, so you've gotten back to this cool point, because the kids are older.
Yeah. How's that working out there for you, V?
How about moms? Can moms be cool?
Yes.
Well, the mom is
You're
a lot younger.
You're just saying that. Yes. You don't think that's true.
I just don't think young kids are cool. They cry, they... Throw things everywhere.
Right,
spit
so
up.
There's George Clooney, who's always dashing, and now he's got spit up on his tuxedo jacket, and that's your problem, right?
Yeah.
I understand that.
And he has, like, a crying baby. Like, it's just not as an appealing image.
Right. It's not the George Clooney.
Like, George Clooney sipping a martini in his pool.
Exactly.
You know?
It's because when you have kids... Being a father takes away your bad boy image.
Right. But you also, I think there's this. I think for some people, the George Clooney is also a father image, and he's wiping spit up off his jacket is adorable. It's a whole new kind of sexy.
I mean, I think a lot of young men will tell you that women never pay as much attention to them as right after they're married, right?
Yeah.
Did you get that, John?
Right after they're married or right after they have kids?
Right after a guy gets married, all of a sudden all these other girls start paying attention.
Well, yeah,
to him.
That's different than a guy with dads.
I have no recollection of that point in my life or that phenomenon ever happening.
Maybe it's still coming. Violetta, you okay?
Wanted to make a...
She's got a mean streak, you know that.
I didn't know that about her, but
I
it's
don't.
Coming to the fore, that's for sure. Thomas Jefferson tickets are still on sale if you go to WGNradio.com. Now, Elif, we have two cuts in there, and I'm not sure if you are ready with the right one. One was him talking about the press. One was him talking about the Declaration of Independence, and somebody asked if Benjamin Franklin was going to write it. That's the one that I want, the second one, what it was like writing the Declaration of Independence. If you're not playing the right one, I'll stop you. But this is just a sample of what it's like. So President Jefferson comes on stage. I talk to him for a little bit, and then you get to ask questions. In this day and age, wouldn't it be interesting to know what one of the founding fathers would say about our attitude about the Electoral College or about impeachment or about dealing with NATO and what our obligations are there, who should be able to vote, who should not be able to vote, the power of the pardon, things that we're all dealing with in real time. But then also, what was it like being in the Revolutionary War? What was it like being in France? What was it like, Lord, it always comes up. Somebody even texted us yesterday. Wait a minute, you're not going to ask him about Sally Hemings? It'll come up, I promise you. But he never addresses it. He never has too much to say about it. We'll see how it goes. It's always enlightening. The title of this year's show is Thanks, President Jefferson. We needed that, and we do. Okay, so somebody asked him why Benjamin Franklin did not write the Declaration of Independence.
Franklin decided not to write it. He would have been the perfect person to write it, but he said he would never again agree to write anything subject to committee review. And he was right by that.
Thank you for that question. How many letters did you write in your life?
Approximately 26,000. That's not so many. That's not so many letters. That's about three a day. But here's what I did. Here's what will astonish
you. For your whole life, yeah.
Well, you have to get up early. I didn't sleep much. I was essentially a vegetarian. I got exercise every day. I rode my horses or walked. I ran as a boy, as a young man. I never drank spirituous liquors, ever. I only drank a little wine, and I watered my wine down with water in the European style, and I made sure that I kept myself healthy. 26,000 sounds like a lot of letters. If you saw the process, you would even be more astonished, because I never just wrote a letter. I wrote a draft, and then I wrote the letter. So there's a draft, and then you see scratchings out and so on, and then I wrote it in a fair copy of it without all the problems. And then, if you can believe it, I made a copy of the copy because I wanted to have a filing system. Eventually, fortunately, there was a copying press that had felt, and you could put your original letter on and then wet the next piece of paper and kind of run it through a copier, and it would make a very shadowy and imperfect reverse copy. I did that for many years, and then John Hawkins of Philadelphia invented the polygraph. You'd call it a pantograph, but it had two pens on levers connected to a central pulley, and then you could put two sheets of paper on an inclined plane that clamped down, and then ink both pens and fine-tune it a little. And then if you wrote with this hand, this one would create a simultaneous fair copy. You could see that at Monticello. I didn't invent this, but I perfected it. It's very persnickety. And when I finally perfected it, I not only gave copies away to my closest friends so they too could make copies of everything they wrote, but I created a small laptop version for my travels because I wanted a copy. And so if you said to me, like this happened in my relationship with John Adams, when we started being friends again after 1812, he would write and say, Mr. Jefferson, in a letter that you wrote in 1787, you said that I was susceptible to British influence. I challenge you on that. And then I'd just go find the letter. I was maybe the most organized person who ever lived on the earth. I had five daily diaries. Five. I had a weather log.
And on he went. You know, that little mini monologue there is a flawless answer to a question he did not know was going to be asked. And we do 2 hours of that. About an hour and a half of that. Sometimes we go long. But you hate to not take advantage of the opportunity when the third president is standing there to ask him some questions. So Thomas Jefferson on stage. Bring your friends. I saw Sarah Johnson, a friend of mine, today. I said, Sarah, you and your mom, Joanne, the former First Lady of Letters from Sandwich, Illinois' public library, are Sarah and Joanne going to come to see Thomas Jefferson? And they are. I hope you come, too. Go to WGNradio.com/events to get your tickets. WGNradio.com/events to get your tickets. All of our texts are about two topics. The confrontation at the Forest Preserve. Should that Forest Preserve officer lose his job or not? And who's better, the Beatles or Drake? This is an interesting point about the Beatles-Drake story. John, I think the percentages of records sold per population means the Beatles win. That's a good point, right? Because Drake has seven, maybe not. Okay, but I'll finish the thought. Drake has seven songs on the top 10. The Beatles had five. But probably as a percentage of the population, say the Beatles sell a million records.
Over what period of time?
Never mind that. Say the Beatles sell a million records. That means, and there's fewer people in the United States in 1964. If Drake sells a million records, there's 100 more million people to buy them than there were when the Beatles. So Drake will always sell more. But this, but maybe that doesn't matter because they're not saying he sold more than the Beatles. They said he's got seven of the top 10 songs on the charts. He's competing with everybody else right now. It's apples to apples. The Beatles were competing against everybody in Beatles time, and they had five. Drake's competing against everybody today, and there are arguably more artists with more ways to get music out, and Drake has seven of the top 10 songs on the charts. John, I'm sorry, but I'm 52 years old, and the Beatles are like nails on a chalkboard. I also don't see how it could rate numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. How did they do that? But this texter says, John, Drake doesn't come close to the Beatles. It's a bunch of monotone crap. About the police officer at the Forest Preserve, John, why did not the officer confront the drunk? You're not allowed in the Forest Preserve to drink or to be drunk, period. That's a good point. That guy's name is out there, too. They published today the name of both the drunk man who confronted the woman and the officer who's now on desk duty. From 708, fire the county police officer. 708 also says, I think he should get fired. He clearly did not care about the white drunk guy or the safety of that woman who is asking for help. It's inexcusable. Tolerance to racism is not acceptable in a public safety position. And I guess at the end of the day, that's what was on display, right? John, how can you even compare the two? Fine, he's got more songs, but they're all crap. I'm not trying to make converts to Drake here. I'm just trying to sort of illuminate you and me so that we better understand what's out there. And that Drake, he's a going thing. You watch the videos too. They're pretty good. I know you won't watch the videos, but trust me. John, not a prayer. Haven't heard of Drake. I must live under a rock. I think I'll stay here. That's the point. Let's not do that. Let's not be those guys. I know some people of a certain age who say, well, I'm not going to try anymore. And they're talking about technology, which is really hard to keep up with, right? Like you figured out Facebook and then they said there's Twitter. You figured out Twitter and then they said there's this thing called Instagram. And so you've got to learn a whole new platform.
Yeah, but that's not a generational thing. Every individual person might feel that way. Like, I know people my age that have given up on Facebook or that I don't do Snapchat, per se. Like, I can't get into it.
Yeah, I tried Snapchat for a while, and it was...
It's crazy for me.
It was a lot of work, it seemed to me, for me. And the payoff wasn't. And then I was looking at Snapchat, so I thought, okay, I get it, but it just didn't seem to me to be worth the effort.
It's not as appealing. So, I mean, it doesn't matter what generation you are. Sometimes you're just not going to pick things up.
But I feel guilty that I'm not more on Insta and I spend more time on Facebook and Twitter.
It's just not as intuitive yet, but
it will be for me maybe in time.
Yeah.
But so, and those are just, you know, and those are just social media outlets. Think about the technology. So again, I said, I know people of a certain age who've just said, I'm not going to try anymore. Not only do they not seem to be able to or interested in keeping up with all of these new things, but then think about that. They went from a computer on the desk to a computer on their lap to a pad to a phone, and the technology is changing and the operating systems within the technology is getting more advanced. And sometimes they just throw their hands up and say, ah, I'm not going to do it. So I'll say, Mom, just send me a picture of that from your phone. Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
My 84-year-old grandmother in Serbia FaceTimes me every day.
Oh, I walked in on that. She's in Serbia?
She's in Serbia.
And
great
you were talking
Wi-Fi.
To her. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. And she every day is like, listen, someone just wrote this on this. I got to learn how to do this. And I have to slow her down. I'm like, listen, you're going to forget how to turn it on if I tell you, you know, 10 steps ahead. So I
but
try to keep
she's
it simple.
Able to, you know, and my folks FaceTime when my sister was living overseas, and this wasn't that long ago, and my dad just celebrated his 90th birthday. So they were in their 80s, my dad anyway, and he was FaceTiming with my sister overseas. And I thought that was awesome. I was so happy for them.
Yeah,
they were
I mean,
still
it's
able
amazing.
To connect. But you get my point, right? That there are...
Yeah, I mean, I think about what I'm thinking about the progression my grandmother has gone through. You know, she grew up in a field in Serbia. The technology that she's using now has to be just way afar from what she thought she was going to ever be using or...
It would be like a spaceship right. to these people. I mean, think about that. I thought about that about my dad, who is actually pretty good about this. My dad texts me a lot. We obviously talk on the phone. He's on his computer a lot. He's got his pad out. I'm like, you go, man, because if your father is 90 years old as mine is, that means he lived his youth without a television in his home. And then he got a black and white TV. And then somebody on the block, maybe, I don't know when, probably in his 20s, maybe they knew somebody with a color TV. Oh, heck no, he'd have been older than that. Somebody may have had a color TV. I mean, and then just fast forward through all of that. TV's getting smaller, VHS and beta.
Right, there's so many different changing
CDs,
things.
CDs, cassette tapes. I mean, get all the way to streaming and then live chatting with your daughter on the other side of the phone world through your phone. I mean, unbelievable technology that they've had to keep up with. So why are we even talking about this? Because I'm saying that I hate to see people say, okay, it's too much anymore. It's too much mental homework. I don't want to learn or continue to participate. Because then you check out. Now, I'm sorry, but everybody else will be over there doing that thing. And you're over here now saying, I got off the bus. And I hate to see that happen. This somehow relates to the conversation about Drake, right? All I'm saying is,
stay relevant.
Yes, you don't have to like Drake. All I'm telling you is 7 of the top 10 songs in America are his, and there's probably something to it, even if it's not to your ear. It's not a bunch of crap or garbage because half the planet is listening to it and enjoying it. They used to say this about Celine Dion or other actor singers that maybe we're more familiar with, right? And it was very easy to go, oh, that's... Her singing's garbage. It's crap. And I always threw up my hands and said, I don't like it either. But she just sold 200 zillion, you know, 11 jillion CDs. So maybe there's something to it. It's as much about me as it is about them. I can live with that. I don't have to like it. John, are you kidding me? Every Drake song sounds like the last one. Hello, Karen Carpenter. John, my kid sings to all of the Drake songs. Of course they do. John, Drake can't come close to the Beatles. It's a bunch of monotone. There's that conversation today. Oh, we got time here for maybe just 30 seconds of each of them. Ones that we haven't played yet, Elif. So I think we left off with... we did Drake in My Feelings, which would have then been the counterpart for the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand. Say that something. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Okay, so that's the Beatles. That's the Beatles at number 4 on the charts in 1964. The equivalent of that would be Drake. This will be number 7 on the charts right now, Elif. I'm Upset. Is asking if I'm cool, I'm upset. 100,000 on my head is disrespect. So offended that I had to double check. You trying to check?
This is real life. Think we playing chess.
We finally got the news click up, so you will if you go to WGNradio.com right now. Go to WGNradio.com and then scroll down a little bit, and on the left-hand side, you'll see a story and a link to the video that we've been talking about, the police officer that did not intervene for that woman at the Forest Preserve. The question is, should he lose his job? Right now, a third of you are saying he should be fired. I suspect that number might change. WGNradio.com is where to go.
Here's John Williams.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get rolling then. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here until 3 o'clock weekdays, Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. On social media, WGN King John. And at WGNradio.com, we just posted a short while ago our daily web poll question. It's the news click. It's kind of new. We used to do it. We brought it back. Today we're asking you what should happen to that Forest Preserve police officer who did not come to the aid sufficiently of that woman with the flag of Puerto Rico on her T-shirt. You've got three options there. One is he should be fired. The other one is he should keep his job. And the third option is that he should keep his job, but he should suffer some punishment. Just before the break, we said a third of you are saying that he should be fired. That's up to 46% now, and I think it's probably going to cross the 50-50 line soon. I'm not going to tell you how to vote. Go to WGNradio.com. You'll find the news click about halfway down on the left-hand side. It's also on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John. Okay, so in our studio right now are two names that you probably know. One is Kevin Magnuson, the outgoing president of the Special Olympics here in Chicago and the co-chair of the 50th anniversary of Special Olympics in this fair city. Nice to meet you. Welcome.
Nice to meet you, John. Thanks for having me.
And sitting next to you is Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke, the founder of the Chicago Special Olympics. Justice Burke, welcome to the studio.
Well, thank you, John. Good afternoon.
What a pleasure to meet you in person. I know both of your names, and I know Magnuson, your dad, Keith, was with the Blackhawks. I used to not only enjoy watching him play, I enjoyed watching him just skate around the ice before he started to play. Nobody came out with more energy than he did.
That was his way to get not only his team going, but the crowd at the old Chicago Stadium going, and something that he was very proud to do. And, you know, wearing the Blackhawk sweater for 11 years, you know, just brought him great joy, and being a kid from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, to come to the big city and have a chance to play with Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita was a thrill of a lifetime.
So how did Special Olympics get started?
Well, John, back in 1965, I was a young phys ed teacher with the Park District.
And from Southern Illinois University?
No. In fact, I was a college dropout in 1965.
I thought I saw you see somewhere on
well,
your resume.
You did. You saw that. It's very perceptive of you. In 65, we went to Southern Illinois University, the 10 teachers who volunteered to work with special needs kids, to get a four-day, how do you do this? Because at that time, there was no ADA, no special education, no recreation in the United States. I mean, children with special needs and adults were in institutions or they were in the closet. So it was actually no one was, you never saw anybody with special needs at that time in the 65. Of course, you're young, John, so you wouldn't remember that. But in 65, that's the way it was. So we had 10 parks. Kennedy Foundation gave $10,000 to start the program. And my kids did everything. I taught them to twirl baton, tap dance, swim, track and field, all of that, basketball, all the things I loved to do. And they became great at it. The president of the park district, Bill McFetridge, came out to the park. He said, how many kids like this live in the city? And at that time, in 65 to 67, no one knew in the United States or in the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois how many people with disabilities there were.
Think about what a leap it was. Sports weren't offered to women of any stripe, let alone people with some sort of developmental disability.
Correct.
The idea that you would also then embrace them, I'll bet people even worried about their health. Can they actually do this without injuring themselves? I mean, there must have been a whole host of hurdles.
Absolutely.
For you to cross.
Fortunately, I did not know that I couldn't do something. And nobody actually told me. People were just grateful that the kids were having fun, just like their other kids. You know, once we got more children to come to the park, and everybody realized they have more abilities than any kind of disabilities. We all have differences. So it was just like teaching basketball or tap dancing to anybody in a class. You come at different levels in the class.
So is the idea to sort of copy the Olympics?
Yes. McFetridge said, how do we find out how many people? And I said, well, the regular park program has a summer jamboree. We should have a citywide track meet. And that's when I called Dr. Freeberg from Southern Illinois University to consult with us. And if he thought this was a good idea, because he was the guru, then we were ready to go ahead. And he suggested that I write to Mrs. Shriver.
He was the guru of what?
Outdoor education and recreation.
Yeah. So then he says, reach out to the Kennedys?
He did. He was a former director of the Kennedy Foundation in the late 50s and early 60s. And he said, I bet Mrs. Shriver would like to do this. Why don't you write to her? So he helped me write the letter. I sent the letter. She wrote, called back and said, come on out to Washington.
How old are you at the time?
23. So don't start counting. I'll tell you how old I am now.
No, but I mean, I so appreciate the ambition on your part and the receptivity, whatever it is, how she was open to it, that she was willing to listen to you.
She was. She always was active with Rose, her sister Rosemary, and this was a new breakthrough, she felt, and was encouraged that the Chicago Park District, a huge park district program, was willing to take it on, and which we had already had 2 years under our belt working with the kids. So we had our first games July 20th, 1968, 1,000 children.
Was that a success?
Huge.
When did you know you had something? When did you, what was the moment? Did a lot of people sign up, or was it the crowd that showed up? When did that first year you go, wow?
There was no one in the stands. The only people that came were the special needs kids, the volunteers, and some Chicago Park District people to help us do the games. There was nobody. But you knew by being there and watching the kids and the parents that this was something special. And so did Mrs. Shriver, because when she was there and she saw that, she decided right then and there at the closing ceremony, she announced that she was going to take this national.
Hmm. The 50th anniversary in Chicago starts July 17th,
yes.
Right? We have activities not only at Soldier Field, but at Toyota Park, right? Is it throughout the city that we're going to be doing these things?
Yes, so from July 17th to the 19th, we're having a unified football cup, and unified play is a huge goal of Special Olympics. That's athletes with disabilities and athletes without disabilities playing together on the same team versus one another.
Will these be teams from Chicago or from around the world?
Chicago will definitely be represented, but then 25 countries are fielding teams and coming to Chicago next week.
Do they play their own competitive matches to get there? How does a team get formed?
Exactly. So they play their own matches to win the chance to be here next week in Chicago and play at the CIBC Fire Pitch. So that's July 17th to the 19th. And then the finals, the men's and women's finals, will be on July 20th at 5 p.m.
Has it always been integrated like that, people with disabilities and people that don't have disabilities?
This is a newer concept, but those with disabilities and non-disabilities have always played together, but it's never really been official until about 10 years ago where they really tried to push this program.
Do they sort of, how do you coordinate the scoring then? Wouldn't the able-bodied people be more adept at scoring and playing and competing, or not necessarily? Anna's shaking her head.
Not necessarily. You're right, because some of the Special Olympians are fantastic athletes. They've been working hard with their skill learning. Obviously, there's some differences, but that's the part of the unified team. Each has some abilities, and even able-bodied kids have some disabilities. There's a lot of differences. I mean, some are really good at catching and kicking, and some are not. So,
well, it's a literal and a representative sort of integration then, isn't it?
Yes.
As much as we want them to be part of society and society to be part of them, so too will we integrate them on the playing field, not isolate them. I presume that's the idea.
That's exactly the idea. And the younger that occurs, as the theory goes, yeah, then it just becomes everyday life.
What sort of disabilities are we talking about? I mean,
well, first of all, mental disabilities. And there's accompanying that, there's often a lot of physical disabilities. You have to have, you know, a mental disability to be in Special Olympics.
So then there's, I know what that means, but I don't know exactly how that happens.
Well, all are different. I mean, we all do have different IQs and differences. And, you know, it's just in the room right here we're in is that we're different and we have disabilities. I'm dyslexic, but I'm able to do what I do. Doesn't mean I can't learn to do what I'm doing. And if the younger you get, or you are, and learn how to cope with some of these things and excel, you can do things.
You said a moment ago you were a college dropout at one point.
Yes.
I presume you went back.
I did, but after I had my family.
Yeah.
I didn't go back until after I was married and had three children.
Was the dyslexia that which kept you from getting an education on a four-year path?
Yeah, but I didn't know then in the 60s or the 40s or the 50s. Yeah. I just was a C student. Not that that's a bad thing, but I took me forever to read. I wrote backwards. I read backwards the whole nine yards. I still do that, but I've learned. I was diagnosed when I was an adult.
Huh.
After all of that, and then I went to, after I had our fourth child, I went to law school. So when I started law school, I had four kids under 10.
So have you been involved in Special Olympics the entire run then, from its inception?
Yes.
You have not left it. And then when did you come into it? When did you get involved?
So my dad passed away in 2003, unfortunately. But really, Special Olympics has been part of my life since day one. My dad was at the third ever Special Olympics Games in Chicago. Stan Mikita grabbed my dad and Cliff Coral.
Wow, really?
And my dad was, one afternoon with the athletes, he was hooked. And
I wonder why. I mean, what is it that makes this connection for people?
It's a contagious affection.
Really?
I mean, you feel that these individuals have been deprived, as other vulnerable people in our society have not been mainstreamed, and they should have been. And so it's contagious. And once you help and they learn and the skills, and Kevin's dad, of course, well, he was the MC for all our Chicago games in Soldier Field for all the years until he passed.
What are the sports that the kids play now, or adults, but what are the sports that we see? Is there soccer, track and field? What else?
Bocce ball, 50-meter dash, like you said, track and field is huge, basketball, floor hockey, flag football is an up-and-coming sport, golf, tennis.
So venues throughout the city, then, these are taking place?
Exactly. Huge support from the Chicago Park District makes it happen.
Huh. So we're going to get this influx of people, I guess, what, any day now? Maybe
any day.
Some of them are already here.
Yes.
How many people will be in Chicago for the 50th anniversary of Special Olympics?
Well, we're hoping thousands.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Athletes, fans, friends, family members.
Yes.
And then the volunteers throughout the Chicago area that are doing
it. And around
it.
The country, the CEOs of all the state Special Olympic programs. Italy, we were in Rome 2 weeks ago now. The Italian Special Olympic team had an audience with the Pope, and I was there. And the Pope lit a flame to have them bring their torch to Chicago, because that may be the only Italian team that's going to win a World Cup unified soccer match. And so he said, win in Chicago.
In fact, are we going to have an eternal flame then?
Yes.
For Special Olympics at Soldier Field?
Yes. The Richard Hunt, a Chicago-born sculptor who is the most commissioned sculptor in the United States, grew up in Inglewood. Has been commissioned to do the most beautiful eternal flame you've ever seen. It's good 30 feet high. It's going to be on McFetridge Boulevard between Field Museum and the north end of Soldier Field. And it's going to be lit by a flame that's been taken from Hyannisport yesterday to Chicago. It was started in Hyannisport, and it's going to be brought to Chicago from the Kennedy compound. I'm lit in Chicago.
Justice Ann Burke's in our studio. Kevin Magnuson is too. He is the outgoing president of Special Olympics here. Okay, so a couple of points about how you want to see this. You want to do this? You want to check it out? We'll get to that next on WGN. And Burke is in our studio. Kevin Magnuson is too. He's the outgoing president of Special Olympics and's been there all along since its founding. Go to SpecialOlympics50.org. That's 50. SpecialOlympics50.org to find out what's going on in Chicago. Starting September 17th at Toyota Park, downtown Chicago, they're actually going to have, are they going to have a torch run with the flame too, Kevin? Are you guys going to do that?
So the law enforcement, local law enforcement, and actually from all around the country are going to run 2 miles starting at 39th Street to Soldier Field. And they're going to pass the torch amongst many police officers on their way to Soldier Field, culminating with them lighting the eternal flame of hope on July 20th at 1 p.m.
And that flame, which we talked about before the break, there's not currently a Special Olympics eternal flame at Soldier Field, but we will have one after this for years and years to come.
Eternal, hopefully.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, congratulations to you guys. If I want to attend, I presume, is there a charge and admission to go see some of the events?
There is not. They're all free events outside of the concert, which is the final celebration on July 21st. We're having a concert at Northerly Island. Chance the Rapper is producing and performing with Usher, Smokey Robinson, OAR, Jason Mraz, to name a few. So
are you kidding me?
Really star-studded.
Are you kidding me?
Concert. Really happy about that.
That's funny because I've seen OAR at Northerly Island before. So I don't know who these other guys are that you just mentioned. I do. But what a lineup. Good for you guys. Okay, so the 17th of July. So we're a week away from, I guess, if you happen to be going down the road and you see some police officers running with a torch, or if you see folks heading to Toyota, Pavilion? What do we
Toyota call? Park.
Toyota Park, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is what this will all be about. Remember, Special Olympics 50, specialolympics50.org is the website to stay abreast of all of this. Congratulations to you both.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this. And, boy, I hope you get a good crowd, too, right?
It's very important because this movement has changed the world. You know, there's 172 countries that have participated in Special Olympics from just in 50 years, changing the stigma against people with disabilities. It's amazing that this kind of movement has occurred. And it's because you said before, how do you get involved? It's because it's a contagious affection. Once you are involved, it's like Kevin's not finished just because he's not president. He's going to be forced, but not forced, but he is emeritus. He's always going to be involved, and his wife and his son, Gunnar, are going to be involved. Everybody's family has been involved, and you can't help it because we haven't done enough yet. We still have long-term residential care for these individuals. After they max out of school in the Board of Education, after they're age 22, they have no place to go the rest of their life, unless it's a park or a special recreation program or Special Olympics. So we have, as a society, a lot to do yet.
Where's the pendulum on care and help for people like this in this country right now?
It's minuscule. Everything has been taken away from long-term residential care. There's no money for people. These children's parents, they get older, their parents pass away, and there's no place for them to go. So this is what we need to do, is to think about this in the future. And raising the awareness through our 50th anniversary, we hope we'll do that.
SpecialOlympics50.org, SpecialOlympics50.org. Both of you, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Well done. Going to be at the baseball game tonight. Going to go see those White Sox redeem themselves after that whooping they took from St. Louis.
Wasn't good last night.
Oh, man. Phil Vitale's in our studio. Hi, Phil. How are you?
I'm good, John.
You a White Sox fan?
Not much. I don't actively cheer against them. I'm a North Side guy.
Oh, really? You're a Cubby guy, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about Croatians? Do you cheer for the Croatians?
You know, last I heard they were losing, but I didn't pay attention.
They tied it up, actually.
1-1 on your way up.
All right.
Isn't that funny? So you don't know a lick about soccer, do you?
Sure.
Oh, you do? You're kind of into the thing?
Not completely, but my son played on a traveling team, so I picked up a fair amount watching.
That's a lot more than most people know
about
soccer.
Yeah, one of the kids on his team plays professionally. He was on the U.S. national team last time around.
Here's the question, though. What is the disconnect in this country?
The running.
Kids play basketball, baseball, football growing up, and then they aspire to be that. Why isn't soccer like one of our major sports? The kids are playing it, and they love it, and their moms and dads go to the games and stand there in the rain. Why don't we have a better appreciation for professional or international soccer in this country?
I don't know.
It just Maybe seems we really will. Hard.
I think we will need to create a team. It might be a chicken-egg thing in which we need to create a team that is really, really competitive at the top national, international level, and then the interest will
I mean, think about
follow.
Golf and baseball. The ball just is there. You hit it. You run a little bit. You're in the sun. You're enjoying some food, some beer.
I think the biggest problem probably culturally for us is the lack of scoring. Baseball, a good baseball game can be 1-0, too. But
sure.
You just have more, there's more action in soccer than there is in baseball. But there is more scoring in baseball, more opportunities to score.
Right, but you know,
more opportunities
in
for
soccer,
success.
The action is nonstop, and there's the opportunity to score is there almost every time. Everybody's one pass away from a legitimate scoring chance. Whereas in baseball, you throw a pitch. Pitch comes back to the pitcher. He stares. He gets a sign. He gets on there. Maybe takes a look over at first. See if the first runner on first is making any business. Maybe not. Okay, and then he goes back. Gets another sign. Another sign. Catcher doesn't like the sign. Shakes it off. And okay, they start with a new sign. Then deliver the second pitch of the game.
You have no chance, Steve. He's not going to stop.
But because, John, you've been watching that game your whole life, you can appreciate that. You can appreciate the signs and looking to first.
Some people find that fascinating.
I do.
If you take a person 35 years old, you know, from around the world, sit them down at a baseball game, they're going to be bored, too, because they're not going to understand it. They're not going to have grown up watching it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference, I think.
Jeff on line one thinks he has a theory on why. We're going to talk food, if that's okay with you, Phil, in just a second.
I can fake it, sure.
Let's go. You are the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune.
That's right.
Hey, Jeff, you're on WGN Radio. What's up?
Hey, guys. I was listening, and I appreciate the time. I've been coaching soccer for many, many, many years, and our family is big into soccer. And the conversation that we've been having about the U.S. men's team, which is actually, they're headquartered here in Chicago. I'm not sure if you guys knew that or not. They're down the street from you.
How about
probably
that?
Not.
Yeah, yeah. USA Soccer is in Chicago.
That's what they were doing. That's anyway, what those guys are doing in the parking lot.
That's what they're doing. You know, in most countries, soccer is a sport that people play for fun, like, you know, in Thailand and all over the world. In the United States, Phil, as you had mentioned, your son played travel soccer, and it gets expensive. On the North Shore, second graders play $6,000 to play travel soccer.
Soccer should be the least expensive sport on the planet.
It's a ball in a field.
Right. It's the travel to get to the other competitive teams that you're playing. You spend the money on the road, don't you?
On the North Shore, they have Scottish coaches that they fly in and live with the kids.
Wow.
Okay. Well, that's the North Shore.
Okay. That's on you guys.
But the U.S. team is the best team that money can buy because they can afford that. If you're in second grade and you play until you're 18, that's almost $70,000 paid
over the years
for people to play.
I know a little bit about what it would cost to outfit a baseball player
mm-hmm.
with the best gear. You want your kid to have the best glove and all that jazz. But really, what's it going to cost me to get my kid on a soccer field with the best gear on a competitive team? What am I looking at? Like, what do soccer shoes cost? $100? $50?
Keep going.
Really?
My
kid spends $150 on sneakers now, and he's not playing any sport.
And then what about the shin guards? They wear shin guards and knee pads? But those can't be expensive, right? That's $10, right?
No. I mean, the custom uniforms are expensive. You need a road uniform and a home uniform. No, seriously, you do.
I guess.
You have to have different colors depending on who you're going to play. Because if you go against a team from out of town and they're in black and silver, now what do you do? So you need two sets of uniforms, and you need that. I don't know, coach, is the individual instruction that starts running into big money?
You got to pay for the coach, maybe, something like that?
You know, it's funny because there's systems all around the country. There's the AYSO, which is the American Youth Soccer Organization.
Yeah, yeah.
And the parents coach, so you don't pay for the parents. And
AYSO official.
Ah.
I had no knowledge of the rules.
It fit right in.
But that's what makes it fun, right?
It was,
but then you start to getting into, you get into, like you said, home and away jerseys, and the teams around the North Shore, they're custom made for their body, and they have custom made bags with their names stitched on them.
Nice.
And they've got coaches literally from Europe who come over.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but
live here in the North Shore.
Why don't we like soccer as much here is the question. I mean, it's expensive because it's rare, but why is it rare?
Yeah. I don't know. I think
the coach's point is that it's the price to be a participant at a high level beyond the means of a lot of kids. Whereas a baseball and a bat, now you're playing.
No, but other countries are not more well off, so they're not. You know, it should be inexpensive to play. Then
I'll put this on it. I'll bet it's just the baseball has been in America as a staple for a very long time. Basketball has been a staple here for a very long time. It was invented here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 50 years from now, 25 years from now, we'll look back at this conversation and find it dated because soccer will be you know, Chicago and St. Louis will be a rivalry people will be interested in soccer.
Right.
We don't have that right now. Hey, I got to talk about something else. Jeff, thanks for the phone call. Yeah, nice that you're listening. We appreciate it. Phil Vitale is the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. In the Trib today, you will find in the food section a rundown of some of the food at the Taste of Chicago, and also your review of Le Bouchon and Le Sardine.
Right. Two restaurants owned by the same family.
Tell me about that first.
Okay. They intrigued me because this year, last month, Le Bouchon turned 25 years old. And in September, La Sardine will turn 20 years old. So that's 45 aggregate years for the same family running Chicago restaurants. And it's classic French bistro food, and it's terrific. It was the founding chef was Jean-Claude Poilievre, who tragically died in a weather-related road accident 2 years ago, and his wife and sons have kept the flame going, and the both restaurants, in my opinion, operate at a very high level, and the food is just the classic French dishes you want to want. There's the French onion soup at La Sardine. They have the beautiful Grand Marnier soufflés with raspberry sauce. And you can always get the duck breast, and you can get your steak frites. And you can get the mussels and scallops, you know, Coquille Saint-Jacques and all that great stuff.
Yeah, no kidding. That's why I guess the subtitle to your story is about what a bittersweet anniversary two years is.
Because they're celebrating it without the man who started the whole thing.
Yeah. Pictures in the paper today are beautiful. That maple glazed sweetbreads masking a creamy textured interior at Le Bouchon.
Mm-hmm.
That looks good.
It was good.
Although I don't think I want to eat sweetbreads.
Oh, why not?
Well, because I think I know what sweetbreads are.
They're an internal organ, much like liver. You eat liver, right?
It's in the neighborhood, but
just a quick hard roll, just take a right at the pancreas.
So you give it 2 stars, which is very good.
Yes.
In your review. And is the family keeping the quality and service as high as it was?
I believe so. Yeah, yeah. I think Oliver, who is the chef, is. I wouldn't call him a spitting image of his father, certainly his cooking stands up to that level.
Le Bouchon and Le Sardine. Talk to me about the Taste of Chicago.
It's back, baby. It is here. Just when you thought it was over, they dragged me back in. And it opened today, so it opened a couple hours ago, and my team has been out already, and we have filed our various reports on what we like so far at chicagotribune.com/dining.
What are your people saying they've touched so far that...
Well, let's see, we sent about 6-8 people out, and everybody went to about 5 restaurants. So I think we've hit 40 places so far. I went to 5, and everybody's putting in their little, they like this, they like that.
Now you're posting these online. I presume they'll appear in print as well?
Probably, because by the time our next print cycle comes around, the whole thing will be swept up, and, you know, it's over.
So you got to read it online, chicagotribune.com.
Right this second.
Of the food that you tried, what did you like?
There's a Caribbean restaurant on the south side called Garafana Flava, and it is doing Caribbean food. This is their first time as a 5-day taste participant. They did a 1-day pop-up last year, and they're doing a very nice jerk chicken and then something called panades, which are like empanadas. And it's with a ground fish and corn mixture that's in a deep-fried pastry-based empanada and with a little chilled onion sauce on the side. And it has a little bit of a kick, but not very much. And those things were really tasty. I went to Ricca Benny's, which has been around for a million years, another one around by Sox Park. And they are... they have their breaded Italian steak sandwiches.
Yeah.
Been famous forever, and I would strongly advise you just to skip that because everybody's had it. So what? You know, all due respect to one of the iconic dishes of Chicago, but
I wonder too if these restaurants all do themselves a disservice because it's not the best way and place to eat the food. It's not inexpensive,
right?
I know they want to be there, but I'm not sure that that's a good showcase for what they can do.
Right, and that's interesting because that was the original intent of Taste Chicago, was to showcase restaurants and give people enough of to be intrigued enough that they will go visit the brick and mortar address later.
I'm not sure that it's always a taste anymore, too. It seems like you get more than just a taste, or am I wrong about that?
You are right and you're wrong. The portions have gotten bigger, but the city requires every booth to offer at least two items as, quote, taste, unquote, portions.
Oh, really?
Which are very small, which are basically half portions, maybe a little less, sometimes a little more, and at a lower price. So there's one place that's doing a Hiperito sandwich platter for 20 tickets, which is the equivalent of $15 or close to it. That's a little crazy, but they also do the taste portion, so for about half that, and you get one Hiperito sandwich instead of two. So why would you want two? Get the one.
Yeah, right.
And now you've tasted it. The exercise to me in taste is to get to as many booths as you can.
How were the lines when you were out there, Phil?
Well, I got there right away, so weren't bad. Certainly the food lines weren't bad at all. The ticket booth lines were a little long because for some reason, I will never understand, the taste people put the whole booth up. Here's where the tickets are. And at the north end, buy your tickets here. All that signage, you'd think there'd be room to put the price of the tickets on the outside sign. No. No, that's for you to find out. So all these people walk up and go, how much are tickets? Every transaction.
It's got to be explained, and then here's
exactly.
What you need.
You know, sheet of tickets, $10. Sheet of tickets, $10. Just know that.
And maybe some average prices. I don't know. Help people know what they're going to need when they get out there.
And then at the north end, that they didn't have the credit card window working. They weren't accepting credit cards at noon today, or even at 1 o'clock today. You have to go. Now you can go to the middle booth. There are several ticket booths scattered around.
Okay.
But at the north end one, the one closest to the Art Institute, they weren't taking credit cards. Like, we've been doing this since 1980. Okay.
Let's get our act together, kids.
It's not like this date snuck up on anybody. You know?
Phil Vitale's in our studio. I had a question for you. I got to take a break, Phil. We'll come back. When we do, though, I want to ask you a question about social media, people posting reviews of restaurants online.
Before you go away,
yeah.
The 90 minutes has ended. It's still 1-1 England and Croatia, so they have I think it's 15-15 overtime periods, right, Kevin? And then penalty kicks after that, a shootout after that.
Okay. Yeah, two 15-minute periods or extra time, as they would call it, and if there's still no score then, PKs.
You know, I'm not an expert on international soccer, having only recently discovered it. And by that, I mean 3-4 days ago.
I thought we just solved this issue.
I don't think you should end something as big as this with that kickoff thing, that shootout, whatever you
shootouts,
call it.
Shootouts?
Yeah. Penalty kicks.
Yeah.
Okay, John Williams changes
I agree.
The world.
When I get to be king. Phil Vitale writes about restaurants for the Chicago Tribune. He joins us midweek, most weeks here on the John Williams Show. Phil, let's talk about this another day, but what do you make of online reviews, Yelp and the stuff like that for restaurants?
Everybody's got an opinion.
Some of them look fake to me. I was looking at a restaurant the other day. And so it was just so interesting to me. I don't know how helpful it was, because the ones that were glowing, I thought were fake, maybe four. And some of them were so bad, I thought this may have been their competitor. You know,
right.
I didn't know how to read that thing.
Someone called me once, said, how do you reconcile your reviews with Yelp reviews that disagree? I said, I don't reconcile them at all. I sign my reviews. It's an actual name. It's got an email address. People can write or call and tell me I'm wrong or call me bad names. But the anonymous reviews, is that the chef's mom? Is that the chef's revenge-seeking ex-girlfriend? Is that the busboy that got fired 2 weeks ago? I don't know.
Yeah. All right, I'm out of time. I'm going to read you a couple and talk more about this down the road. In the meantime, read the Chicago Tribune online or in print. You'll find summary of his. You'll actually find his review of Le Bouchon and Le Sardine, both online and in print. And online right now at chicagotribune.com/dining, you'll be able to catch up with their reviews of the food at the Taste right now,
which we're updating every few minutes.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm in one studio down the hall. Rokon, Anna Devlantis are in the other. Hi, guys.
That's correct. That's correct. And I hope that makes sense. It's because you didn't want to be near us. Isn't that right?
No, I just said you guys have a lot of setting up to do for your show, and I thought it might be better if we had separate studios.
Well, if you had been in our studio today, you would have gotten a popsicle.
Violetta it's not a handy. Popsicle. It's an icy.
I call them popsicles. You know, the ones that are in the little rectangular tubes?
I know. Is there a grape one left? Because those
They're
look
so
really good.
Good.
Blue's gone.
Oh, man.
Blue's the best, and our show really likes blue.
Yep. It's the best one. I think it's blue raspberry.
Any other topics on tap today?
No, that's it. We're just going to talk about ices. It's, you know, that's kind of, that's on a summer, beautiful summer day.
Yeah.
Could you get a more beautiful day than this?
No.
I mean, what kind of person are you? Do you cut the top or do you rip it off with your teeth?
I was looking to cut the top and then she's handing these out and now I'm all
we're
sticky.
All sticky. We're
new studios. If you get, now, here's the thing.
There's
a
memo out about not putting food in the studio.
Oh,
correct.
I didn't see that.
Especially sticky food.
Right.
Okay. Don't tell anybody.
So, nice job, Violetta.
I didn't bring them.
All right, I'm going to go get an icy thing. I'll see you guys later.
All right, thank you, John.